He spent World War II catapulting off a Navy cruiser as a radio man on a two-seat scout plane. He survived plenty of close calls, but only after a kamikaze attack left him on fire and jumping overboard did he question his survival.
That's the time it flashed through my mind. This is the end, Jordan. I won't see home again.
Don't miss this Visalia veteran story on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ. Maybe you hear us on the AM side at 1 o'clock, maybe on the FM at 5 o'clock, or even online at kmjnow.com. But you know that each week we catch up with World War II veterans. We ask them to tell us some of their stories because we want to honor them for what they've done, remember their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve those stories for the rest of us to be able to hear for years to come. And along the way, I think we learned quite a bit about what it was like to be alive during World War II, what it means to be a part of America's greatest generation. And today, we're going to visit in Visalia with John Likem, Visalia, California. If you've been to the Visalia Country Club, maybe you've seen him hit one of his six holes in one in his many years on the golf course. Maybe you know him from the veterans group over at Gateway Church in Visalia. And maybe, like me, you're meeting him for the first time in this conversation today. We're going to hear about a very close call he had aboard the USS Columbia during World War II. Last week, we heard a bit about kamikazes, and that's going to be a major topic of discussion today. But let's start early on. Take us back, if you can, Mr. Likem. You grew up in Nebraska, western Nebraska. Well, I imagine you'd never heard of Pearl Harbor before December of 1941. Where were you, and how'd you hear about that?
I was in California at the time, staying with my brothers. I just got out here just a couple of months before.
That's right. You told me you left Nebraska for California on a lark with nothing really to your name. You were just 19 years old, and your parents didn't even think you were serious. And then a couple months later, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
And we'd gone downtown to a little cafe to get the Sunday paper, and when the news came over the air. So that was about the time. And then I stayed with him for another month or two, and then I decided to go up the Bay Area to go to work in the shipyards. I got up to the Bay Area, to Oakland. The only way I could get to the shipyards, I had to be a member of the union, and I didn't have any money to get in the union. So I looked for another, went to the unemployment, so they fixed me up with another job. Actually, I worked at the Chevrolet assembly plant for about 3 months, and then they closed up to make war materials. So then they got a job lined up at Cutter's Laboratory, that make all types of medicines and whatnot. So I worked in the blood plasma department there for about a year, and then I decided I better join the service or because otherwise I was due to be drafted. So I quit my job there and went back home for a vacation, and I enlisted in the Navy. That was September the 4th, 1942.
And you said something there. You didn't want to wait to get drafted. You enlisted in the Navy. Were you concerned that you might end up in the Army on the front line somewhere? Is that what you were trying to avoid?
I decided I wanted to go in the Navy. I didn't want to go with the Army, so I decided to go with the Navy. I had no idea what the Army was like either, so, but the Navy sounded more interesting to me. And plus, I'd probably get to travel a little bit around the world, which I did, not very far, but the South Pacific, which is where I was all the time.
And when you enlisted in the Navy, did you think they were going to put you in an airplane?
No. Oh, no, I had no idea. I volunteered that after I'd been in the Navy, I guess about 6 months, when I graduated from radio school in Bedford, Pennsylvania. And I got my third-class petty officer's degree there. Before I left, they asked for volunteers to go into the Navy, into the aviation. So I immediately jumped on that and volunteered for that. Then I was sent to Memphis, Tennessee, to aviation radio school, and I was there for 10 months more, and then from there I went to Jacksonville, Florida for flight training.
These days, we think of naval aviators, and it's no big deal. It's so commonplace. We see planes on all these aircraft carriers. But you volunteered for something at the time was pretty unorthodox, pretty untested, and pretty new. I mean, it wasn't so easy to fly a plane off of a ship.
Well, no. They already had aircraft carriers, but I didn't know anything about them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when I got to training school, I thought, well, I'm probably going to end up on an aircraft carrier. But they put me on a seaplane base with a search and rescue plane. PBY is what we were. And I expected to go out to the South Pacific when they sent me out there to go to a base that had the PBYs and had the search and rescue planes. But I didn't end up there either. When I got out there, Navy decided they wanted, the USS Columbia wanted 2 new radium, and they were transferring their radium and off and also several of their pilots. And they got a whole new crew. I was on the top of the list, so that's where I went. Myself and another radio, when we went to the USS Columbia, never having been on a ship before, on a Navy ship, I was kind of scared to death, to tell you the truth. I had to learn how to board a ship, how to meet the officer on deck, and how to salute the flag, and how to salute the officer and get aboard. I had to learn all that beforehand. I had somebody tell me what I had to do. So anyhow, I went aboard that ship, and that's... Then they told me the planes I was going to have to fly on, they were back on a catapult, and I had never seen one of those before either.
So the story keeps changing for you. You expect to be in a PBY, which is a big two-engine plane that lands and takes off on the water. Instead, you're going to be catapulted off of a light cruiser. Now, that sounds like something that the circus would do, but not something necessarily you wanted to do. Was it as crazy as it sounds?
It was rather strange, but of course, catapulting wasn't so bad. It's recovering. Mm-hmm. We had to land in the water while the ship was moving. The ship would make a turn and make a slick in the water, probably 50 feet long or 100 feet long, and that's what we had to land in. And they'd put out a rope with a cargo net type of sled, dragging it in the water, and we'd run up on a cargo net sled. Our pontoon had a hook on the bottom of it. He'd cut the engine, he'd settle down, and the cargo net would catch it, pull us up. In the meantime, as soon as he cut the engine, it was my job to climb out of the rear seat, straddle the pilot, get a cable out and a hook, and I'm getting ahead of myself here.
That's all right.
But anyhow, I had the crane operator would swing a cable with a big hook on it down to me, and I'd catch it. Not the first time every time, but I would catch it after a couple of tries. And I'd hook it on, and they tow us and put us aboard the ship on the, they had a saddle made that sat on the catapult. And they'd put us on there, and they'd strap us in there. And then that's the way we got off. Then when they got ready to take off, we all got in the plane and the pilot would wind that engine up wide open, and one end of the catapult, the other was about 40 feet. And that by the time we get that 40 feet, we're at flying speed.
Is this one of those where what made the catapult send you airborne was the firing of one of the ship's guns?
Yeah, well, the catapult had a big powder charge in it that would tow us to the end of the thing, and plus that would give us the real boost to get us started. And by the time we got the end, the engine would be gone and have enough draft to get us up in the air. We never flew more than 90 or 100 miles an hour, and most of the time we flew at 75. Yeah, especially when we did a lot of observation work. You know, we'd fly right over the treetops looking for targets for the ship to shoot at.
And I want to ask you some more about your duties, but I want our listeners to understand what this was like, because I'm sure at the time it seemed fine to you, but looking back now and seeing where technology is now, does it seem like what you guys were doing was pretty primitive?
Yes, it was pretty primitive. They hadn't been doing it very long, but and even the planes we had, they had developed a couple of new planes, but they were not powerful enough, so we had to go back to using the old planes that were built in 1935 and 36.
And what kind of plane was this that you were flying these observation missions on?
It was a Curtiss Scout Observation, built by Curtiss. It was a two-wing plane with a pontoon. On the tip of each wing, we had a pontoon, and the main pontoon was under the belly of the ship. That's where we'd land.
And if you want to see a picture of that, you can go to kmjnow.com. You can also see pictures of Mr. Lycum then and now, some of his medals and some other mementos from the war. So this plane, It's you and the pilot. Those are the only two people on the plane?
That was all, just the two of us. I was the back seat, but I had all my radio equipment and all stuff right in front of me. And I had also had a stick I could fly the plane if I had to, which I did, flew it, but I never did land it. But I used to fly the plane.
Did you ever feel like a guinea pig or like you were in a great deal of danger?
I never give it a thought. Yeah. I just took it for granted. This is what I had to do, and I did it. That's all. It took me about two or three flights to learn what I had to do to land and take off and whatnot, because I had never done anything like that before. So somebody just had to tell me what to do, and that I just did it.
So you had to know in case your pilot was incapacitated or something?
Yes. Well, we went out on a couple of fun flights a few times when we were in Pearl Harbor. We flew over to one of the other islands for recreation. And on the way back, my pilot asked me to fly it back because he wanted to rest. I guess he'd had a few drinks. And he wasn't sure whether he could make it back, I guess. Yeah. So as soon as we got in the air, he says, "John, take over." And I took over the stick and flew it back to Pearl Harbor. When we got near the island, I woke him up, and he took over. And I told him I refused to land it because I never had any practice, and I didn't want to crash.
I don't blame you. Was that a rush for you? Was that exciting?
Well, it was not exciting. It was just work. Just part of my job. I never did get excited over it, no. I knew that this is what I had to do, and that's so I just did it. That was all.
Give us a sense, if you can, of what, I know there's nothing typical, every time is different, but what kinds of things were you doing when you were catapulted off that ship and had a mission to go observe something and record something? What kinds of things were you doing, and what were your specific duties?
My specific duty was actually just to make sure that the radio equipment and everything worked, or if we need to send us any signals to the ship, I had to know how to use the signal light. That we had radio silence when we were in the VOR zone, where we had to have radio silence. Then I had to use a light and give signals with a flash, with a light.
Morse code?
Yeah, Morse code. Yeah, we had to know the Morse code. Or, of course, I had to learn the Morse code before in radio school and everything else, but I don't know any of it anymore.
That's okay. I think we can communicate just fine. So did you ever have a sense that what you were doing was dangerous, that you were putting yourself in harm's way?
I guess I maybe in the back of my mind I thought of it, but I never let it affect me any. I never let it affect me in any way at all. One time we were abandoned out. When we came to land, we were abandoned out the ocean. All the ship was taken off. I said to my pilot, I said, "Well, goodbye, ship. We thought we would never see it again," because they cut us loose. But anyhow, when we saw the ship slow down, I finally convinced the pilot that we ought to try starting that engine. Maybe we could catch up with him. And he said, "Oh, it won't start because the prop, we hit the side of the ship and the prop had bent in, the tip of the props had bent in." So I kind of got mad at him, really, and I started using a little bad language. I says, start that engine. I says, "Try it." He says, "Well, you think there's a cartridge in it?" I says, "Yes, there's a cartridge in it. Start the engine." He finally started the engine. As soon as the ship saw that we got the engine started, well, they dropped out of formation and slowed up, and we finally caught up to them, and they got us aboard.
Because you can't take off again into the air because you need the catapult for that. Yeah. And so you guys are all alone in the ocean?
Yeah, all alone. There was three or four cruisers and four or eight destroyers, but they were all in formation. They were leaving because we're the only ones that couldn't get the ship, our plane aboard, because the sea was rough. Float that was flowing us flung us over to the side of the ship, and the engine was still idling. And as soon as we hit the side of the ship, the wingtip hit the ship and threw the prop in. The prop hit the side of the ship. The engine immediately, of course, they cut the engine immediately because we didn't want to hurt the ship. And the guy up on top, on the top of the deck, he had a big axe, and he chopped the rope in two to let us go because they didn't want to damage the ship any by crashing into it. So that's why we were out there floating.
So it was a botched landing, and you guys were expendable, and you thought you were just going to be Robinson Crusoe or something, huh?
Well, if we would have been, but we were not in the actual war zone, If we had been, they would have probably left us because they continued on with their mission. We were out just taking a dry run on what we were going to have to do the next day or two, whatever it was, and when we were practicing this landing and taking off. But that wasn't very bad. We come back many times with 50 caliber bullet holes in our wings. That we fly right over the treetop looking for the targets for the ship to shoot at. And we didn't even know where anybody was shooting at us. They wouldn't open their anti-aircraft guns, the Japanese wouldn't, because they didn't want to give away their secrets.
Because you guys are flying around looking to see where their positions are, so if they fire at you, they do your job for you.
Right. They wouldn't open up their anti-aircraft guns until the morning of the invasion, then that when we bombard them and the troops start coming in, then they would... Any planes around, they would shoot us with the aircraft. Well, I forget which island it was. We're in so many islands, I can't remember which one it was, that we came back, anti-aircraft going out all around us, and we come back, it had blown part of our pontoon off, and we didn't think we could land. When we got back to ship, why, they'd give us a red flag and a red light, don't land. Circle low over the ship first, and we want to see how bad your pontoon is damaged, so... So we did, and they said, well, it just looks like one section of the back of the pontoon is gone. It ripped a big hole in it. We'll slow down, and you land that thing as close as you can to the cargo net, and we'll see if we can get you aboard. Well, we did. Pilot was real good. We got down there, and just went one skip in the water, and we were on the cargo net. He cut the engine, and I jumped out and got the cable hooked up, and when I turned around and looked, our tail was right under my back seat, was almost like this, sinking. So that is a close call we had there.
Well, and I was going to ask you, because when that pontoon is damaged, that's the danger, that when you land that, you're going to crash, you're going to sink, you're not going to survive. So as you prepared for that landing, what was that like on that plane? It's just you and the pilot. Did you feel that fear, that anxiety, that concern that you might not survive this?
No, I didn't. Never give it a thought. I was too busy trying to survive to think about it, really.
Which is probably a good thing.
There were plenty of other times we were in more danger, really. But even then, I can't remember that I was ever in any fear that I wasn't going to be able to make it.
Was that just your... personality? Was it faith? What was it?
I don't know. I don't know how the pilot felt, but I know how I felt. I was too busy trying to survive. It's like when we got hit with the kamikaze planes, when I was on fire and jumped in the water. Never even gave it a thought, except when I first got in the water, I jumped in the wake of the ship when it rolled me under, and I couldn't get to the top. And that's the only time that I said in my mind, I said, well, looks like this is the end, because I couldn't hold my breath any longer. And it was in that instant that my head popped up above the water. I had a CO2 thing, and I finally got it exploded, and it pushed me up out of the water. I gasped for air. Of course, I got nothing but salt water in there. But
well, and you've just given our listeners a good reason to stick around after this brief commercial break. John Lycum is going to tell us about that brush with a kamikaze aboard the USS Columbia. I'll also have him tell us how distinguished that light cruiser was in World War II. Did a lot of damage against the enemy. John Lycum, 91 years old, of Visalia, California, our guest today. We'll be back with more of Hometown Heroes after this on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending this week with John Lycum of Visalia. He is 91 years old, a Navy veteran of World War II. He was flying on scout observation planes as a radio man, a two-man plane. And you told us, John, about some of these missions where you were shot at. It's one thing to be shot at and to be able to shoot back, but I don't think you had that ability, did you?
Well, I had a gun. I had a 30 caliber gun in the back on a ring. I could shoot, use it, but I never shot at anybody with it. My pilot had a synchronized 50 caliber machine that shot through the prop, but we did empty our guns one time when we came back from mission. We decided to empty it, and that was in the Philippine Islands. No, it was not in the Philippines. It was another island. Yeah. And we decided to go down and empty our guns into some of the trenches that we saw. And when we went down to start shooting in the trenches, right next to the trenches was a grass hut. And a couple of women and two or three kids came running out of there. That was the last time we ever tried that again, because we said, we didn't want to shoot those kids.
Yeah.
We never did that again. That's the only time we ever shot the guns off.
Well, and I want to give our listeners a sense of what you were doing on these different invasions. And the ship that you were on, the USS Columbia, a light cruiser, was just about everywhere in the Pacific. It was in the biggest naval battle at the Battle of Leyte Gulf, but it was a lot of places. How proud are you of your ship's record in World War II?
I'm very proud, because there's not many ships had records like we did, except Cruiser Division 12, which... we consisted of four ships. They were all sister ships, made at the same time, and we operated together most all of the war, except when one of them had to go back to get repairs or something like this. We were all in that action. We all got the same type of rewards for the things we did. And I was proud of the fact that we were in the war, and we sank or had assistant credit for sinking two Navy battleships and four cruisers and about five or six destroyers that we in the two battles we were in. And these were battles that we just, our Navy against the Japanese Navy, shooting at each other. And that's all. We didn't have any aircraft carriers assisting us. They all came later or before doing their bombing. But during the actual fighting of the ships, we were fighting each other.
And when you think about what your ship and what your ship's batteries were able to do to the enemy, and you think about what your role was flying these observation missions, how does that tie together, and how important was what you and all those pilots did to the success that your ship had?
During the battles, actually, with the Japanese Navy battle, we were not flying at that time. We had to stay aboard the ship to stay out of the way of the big guns. And other than that, why... we watched from aboard.
So when you were flying, it was preparing for invasions and how you would batter the ground forces before the troops came in.
Well, every time we wanted to go invade one of the islands, we'd be there two or three days before, and all our ships would be lined up and everybody just be banging the beach where the landing was supposed to take place. We shot 4,500 rounds of 6-inches and over 5,000 rounds of 5-inch guns bombarding the beaches, then plus all the fighting we did with the Japanese Navy shooting at each other. But we would bombard that beach till there were all the palm trees on the first 100 yards of the beach were nothing but stumps left there, so that they wouldn't have too much opposition. The troops would go in. My pilot and I and the two scout planes, we would cover the landing. We wouldn't fly. We'd fly away where they wouldn't hit us. When they figured they had the thing bombarded well enough, we'd fly in over the treetops to look if there was any other damage that we needed to be done. We'd find something that would need to be destroyed. We'd direct fire to the ship. We'd just tell them to start firing, and we'd tell them to raise a gun 100 feet or 100 yards or 50 yards or whatever it was till we get them on target. We'd say, on target, rapid fire. They'd rapid fire, and then when they destroyed the target, we tell a ship, target's destroyed, no target, such area. And anyhow, that was our job.
And you are the one who's relaying that information to the ship. That was your specific job.
Actually, the pilot did all the specific, but the pilot and I communicate with each other, and he had communication with the ship, and I did too, but since I was not the senior officer of the ship, I just kept my mouth shut and let him do the talking.
But you had to make sure all that radio equipment was working so he could tell him.
I had to make sure the equipment was working.
And you talk about flying at the treetops, and I don't know if people really understand what kind of danger you're in there. And you mentioned the plane being shot up a little bit. How do you deal with that when you know that you are well within range of any weapon these guys have? Even a guy with a rifle can take a pot shot at you.
The ones that shot at us. Yeah, no, we didn't know we were being shot at until we landed and see the bullet holes.
So what you didn't know didn't bother you?
That's right. Didn't bother me at all, no.
Well, one thing that did bother you, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier, let's talk about, now, the Battle of Leyte Gulf is a huge battle, really on four fronts. It lasted forever.
I'll tell you, the incident that happened before that, though. During the landings in Leyte, on the Leyte Gulf.
And this is in October 1944.
Anyhow, the troops landed about a day and a half after they landed. Well, one of our ships was torpedoed during that time, and they had two of their planes flying. We had to take one plane aboard our ship, and another plane went aboard one of the other cruisers. But the day after we got aboard the ship, the captain says, we got to get that plane off here because we're expecting to use the big guns. And we didn't have room below deck for three of them. We wanted room for two. So we're going to have to take one plane ashore. So my pilot and I were chosen to take that plane ashore. They loaded us with gasoline, lowered us over the side because we were just cruising around the harbor there, and said, you take off in the water and fly the plane to the shore and leave it there until we call you to get you back. We got in the water and we couldn't get near. And we were about 20 miles from shore. So we had a taxi all the way to shore. We never could, the plane was too heavy and the sea was too rough. We could never get the plane back on the last step to get it near. So we went ashore. When we got close to shore, it was dark and we didn't know we were going to enemy shore or friendly shore. So I got my signal light out and there was a destroyer escort was patrolling up and down within probably half a mile from the shore. I sent my signal light to him, asking him whether we were heading for enemy shore or friendly shore. We didn't know because it was just 2 days after the troops landed. And so they said, well, you're heading for Red Beach, straight ahead. So anyhow, we kept going. We got within 100 yards of the beach, and here come an amphibious jeep out, wanting to know what the heck we were doing out there. So we told him our story, what happened. He says, well, you can't go ashore because there's too many big rocks on the shore. You'll damage your pontoon. If you got an anchor, throw your anchor out and anchor it out here. It's probably not more than 30, 40 feet deep right here where you are. Anchor the plane, and I'll take you on into shore. So we did this, which was another experience for me. I didn't even know how to tie a Navy. I tied nothing but granny knots. I hadn't gone through training to learn to tie all the different kinds of knots and whatnot. But anyhow, we went ashore. He says, here's an anti-aircraft battery right on the shore. You stay there. That thing is sandbagged all the way around it. You get in there with a crew and stay there all night if you want to stay alive. So we did. We stayed there. And, of course, the Japanese were attacking, dropping bombs, and they were shooting at them all night long. So we stayed there till morning. And then I did the dumbest thing you ever want to do. My pilot and I, those soldiers there that were in the gun emplacement, they were relieved in the morning, and we were relieved with them. So they said, hey, sailors, you want to go souvenir hunting with us? And that was the dumb thing to do. We just go right around this little mountain hill over here. It's about a half a mile around the hill, and there's an abandoned Japanese camp there that was been all blown up and everything else, and it's abandoned. And all kinds of souvenirs over there. We were there last night before dark, and we picked up some souvenirs. My pilot and I says, okay, let's go. So we did. We hiked around there. We got over there and was rummaging around through those blown-up tents and whatnot. And I picked up three or four souvenirs, which I still have. But about this time, we hear shooting going up above the hill right above us. We looked at you, we better get out. There was four of us, two soldiers and us two sailors that were all on. So we better get out of here quick. So we climbed back up on the jeep. There was a jeep trail there. And as we got up on the trail and went about 100 feet or so, here come this Jeep. I'm off the mountain. He had two wounded guys with him. And so he says, boy, he says, what the heck are you guys doing here? Get out of here if you want to stay alive, because I've got a squad up there cleaning up the snipers. He says, and my two of my men got shot, but they're picking off anybody they see. So we ran behind the Jeep all the way around the mountain, and we got around the mountain, and there was the Seabees already working on the road. They were making the road bigger, and they were all hiding underneath their bulldozers. And we got closer, we could hear, bang, bang, the bullets going off the bulldozers. They were shooting at them. So we dove for the nearest one and stayed under there about 20 minutes or so till the men didn't hear any more shooting. So we figured, well, they got the snipers up above. So my pilot and I said, let's get out of here. So we had about 200 yards to go around the mountain, and we ended up down on the beach. And we had all the LSTs and all the big ships were unloading their cargo there. So we decided, well, we need to get something to eat. So we went to the nearest LST, and the skipper there told us, one of the guys says, give these two men something to eat at the galley and assign them a bunk to sleep on. So we did. So we got something to eat, and we got down. And anyhow, I got up my bunk, and I was in there laying. I hadn't even gone to sleep yet, and the air raid went off again. We had Japs were coming in to bomb us. Anyhow, I took off up topside, and no sooner got up side, and one Jap dropped one bomb down. We had an ammunition dump that they were been unloaded there from one of the LSTs. And it hit that ammunition dump, and ammunition was going off everywhere, over the top of the ship and everything. So our skipper from that LST decided we better get off the beach. What were you doing? Anyhow, I'll tell you another story. I'll tell you what happened in the morning. Anyhow, he wiggled the ship off the... We hadn't even started unloading it yet, see? And they had just pulled it up there. And anyhow, we got it off. And all the LSTs that could get off all got off the beach. And went out and circled in the bay all night long. And the Japs were going bombing the beach all night long. The biggest fireworks you ever saw. I never saw anything like it in my life. All those ships were all shooting at the Jap planes. But anyhow, finally by daybreak, everything had quieted down. We pulled back in and running up on the beach. Okay, I told my pilot, he was sleeping in the officer's quarters, and I was sleeping in the enlisted man's bunk. I said, well, I'm going down my bunk, get some shut-eye. I haven't slept for two nights. So I got down my bunk, and I laid down, and I hadn't even gone to sleep. The siren went off again, another air raid. I said, oh, heck, I'm staying right here. I'm going to go to sleep. Well, I no sooner got that out of my mouth, and we got straddled by a bomb, one on each side of us. Blew me right out of the bunk. It didn't hit the ship. It just, the concussion just threw the ship side. So I headed up topside, and I met my pilot up there. He says, John, he says, you know, we better get off this tub. He says, I just found out a while ago it's loaded with aviation fuel. They're getting ready to unload it. If we get hit by a bomb, we won't be anymore. Because we had been down the day before watching him build this airstrip, right, which is about half a mile in from the shore. So we got off of there anyhow. Then we had to see a quartermaster. We got to get some supplies. We're not staying aboard. So we ran into the sergeant that was in charge of supplies on the beach, and he fixed us up with fatigues and boots and a helmet and gave us some mess kits and some K rations. We said, well, we'll have to set up our own camp now. So we stayed there and camped for four days. We camped out there. And in the meantime, we'd met the other pilot who was ashore also there, and his radio men. So we decided, well, we'll stick together because they were from one of our sister ships. We set up camp. We scrounged around, got a big piece of canvas off the beach there, and we set up a tent. And, of course, we dug our foxholes outside the tent so we could get down them in case of air raid. And stayed there all night. Next morning, my pilot went down to the found out where they had radio headquarters, where they're on the beach there, and called the ship to see if we could come back ship. Of course, they'd shoot us out good. We'll call you when we want you back. Stay right where you are, because they were assisting, you know, troops on the beach bombarding, and if they needed any help. We were there 4 or 5 days, it was, and finally we got word to come back to the ship. So anyhow, we had a few experiences while we were there, too. We were there after we finished eating our K rations. I went down to the beach, which is about 100 yards to the beach from where we were camped, to wash out our mess kits. Well, about that time, the air raid went off, and the Japs were coming in, and I saw them coming in, strafing the beach. I dove behind a sand dune. There was a couple of soldiers there that were there, too. They come running off the beach, too. Fortunately, none of they got out of the way before the plane came all the way into us, but one guy, I thought it was funny. We laughed about it. He dove over a sandbar, and it was water and mud on the other side, and he hit right into it. He was nothing but mud. But anyhow, that was one of the other experiences we had. But we finally got back aboard the ship, and we no sooner got off back aboard the ship, and we said, well, we're going to go meet the Jap fleet. Jap fleet's coming down to try to run us off the beach, off of Lady Beach. So all the ships, that were not cargo ships, that were not loaded with, we headed for the beach to meet the Japanese Navy. Well, that was our big battle with the Japanese Navy there. It took us about a half a day going up the slot between the islands and whatnot. We knew the Jap ships were coming because we had good radar. We could detect them, and we set a trap for them. That's what I read now. I didn't know at the time.
You only know what's right in front of you at the time.
The destroyers went in and did all the torpedoing first, but then about that time, we got within range. We could shoot our guns from 20 yards, from 10-mile range, and still have the battle with them. I think we sank two Japanese battleships and a couple of cruisers and two or three destroyers that night. We finally made the Japs retreat. They turned tail and ran to their nearest base because they thought they were about fighting all the big battleships. We did have, at that time, we did have one or two battleships with us, but they laid back and they fire from a longer distance. So.
And what were you doing this whole time?
Trying to stay hiding. Well, whenever I was aboard the ship, my duty was to help if we're actually aircraft were coming to strafe us or bomb. I would be back. We had two 20-millimeter anti-aircrafts right on the fantail. That's where our quarters were all the time. I was to help them with the ammunition, to carry ammunition, see that they had enough ammunition there to reload their guns. That's where I was when we got hit with kamikaze planes.
And before this, had you ever heard of a kamikaze attack?
Well, I'd heard of them, yeah, because they'd started before that. Some of the islands, see, when some of the, they weren't real kamikazes. If their plane was hit with our anti-aircraft guns, they would, if they knew they couldn't get back, they'd just pick a ship and aim this plane for it and come down, crash into it. But when we got the kamikaze attack, this was in Luzon, the invasion after Leyte, and we'd been bombarding there for 2 days, and we were going in for the landing, and they had 85 planes, kamikaze planes, that took off at one time that come and attacked us, and we had 18 ships got hit by kamikazes within about 30 minutes.
85 planes are falling from the sky at one time. I mean, you can't possibly pick them all off.
Well, we had over 100 ships there all over the place, and they would pick a target and hit the nearest one. We got hit the day before. They had different kamikazes would come in, and we got hit the first time the day before, and he came in and hit our superstructure, took our antennas down and whatnot, and the gasoline from the Japanese plane exploded, and we had a fire, but they got the fire out, and then we had no damage except fire damage there, and a couple of antennas from our ship got hit. Then we got hit the next day. They crashed, the second kamikaze crashed. He was heading for number 4 turret on the fantail. He missed the turret and came down right behind it. I was standing 20 feet from where he hit.
And had you been firing at him or loading ammunition for that gun?
There were guns all over the place firing at all those kamikazes.
So you had been providing ammunition for one of those?
I knew he was going to hit us because he pulled it on his aiming rod like he hit. We were the target. So I ducked behind a big old vent that took air, fresh air down below, and it was about this big around.
3 feet wide, maybe?
3 feet in diameter. And I ducked down behind it, and I had another man duck down behind me. He was a aviation machinist mate. He ducked down behind me to keep from falling. You know, the ship was rolling and whatnot. I just popped my arms around it like that, and when he hit, and he exploded, and the explosion of the gasoline just, you know, just was really terrific. It came in, the fire just came around me, set the whole back ship on fire. Didn't burn very long, but it burned us, burned my clothes off. I was on fire when I jumped over the side. It burned the shirt right off my back. Blew the skin off my hands, explosion. All my fingernails turned black. My ears puffed out. My face was all burnt. I had a helmet on, my steel helmet. So I was burned, singed all the way around that helmet. My face, my ears, my hands. And I was stooped down. Even my pants had burned, pulled up, and it burned my ankles. So I knew that I better do something. So I just turned around, had about 10 steps to take to get the fantail. So I jumped over the side end, right in the wake of the ship.
And not to build suspense or anything, but we are overdue for another break. When we come back, how John Lycum survived that ordeal, set aflame by a kamikaze attack. The rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this week with John Lycum of Visalia, a guy who still plays golf at age 91 and twice in the past has shot his age. But back in World War II, he wasn't sure he was going to make it past age 23. That's how old he was when a kamikaze hit 20 feet away from him, left him on fire and jumping off the fantail of the cruiser Columbia. That's where we left off. I'm imagining being engulfed by these flames the way you were, trying to get that fire out. And could you even see where you were going?
I didn't know where I was jumping. I wanted to get out of the fire.
It sounds like something it consumed you so fast that I was curious if you could even see where you were running to get off the ship.
I knew the fantail was right there. Yeah. So I just jumped off the side. We got the nearest place. Several of the guys jumped over the side, and some of them didn't even jump off the side. Some of them, they had steel ladders alongside the ship in the back near the three or four or five guys that they climbed down the ladder, and the wind was blowing the flames away from them, so they were all right. And they stayed aboard, but the rest of us, there were 18 of us on the back that went over the side. And of the 18 of us, three or four of them never did come back. In fact, I watched one of them go down. He was about 50 feet from me when I got the top, and I saw him go down hollering for help. He couldn't swim. I knew who the big old heavy set guy, and his life jacket wasn't holding him up. And he went down the third time and never saw him again. In fact, I thought I was gone because I got down under the water and I couldn't get the top. And if that's the time it flashed through my mind, this is the end, John. I won't see home again. And it wasn't seconds later that my CO2 bottle go off, where it inflated my belt part ways anyhow enough where my head popped above the water. And I was in the water about an hour and a half, and the destroyer was assigned to pick up survivors. So they come out with their motor launch and picking up all the survivors, and we were put aboard the destroyer for that night. And I remember going up, they had thrown the cargo nets over the side of the ship so we could climb out quicker, you know. We climbed up there, and I remember I got to the top of that cargo net ready to get on the ship, and a guy reached down to grab my back to help me on, and I screamed at him. I said, "Don't touch me." You know, he didn't know I was burned that bad, see.
Well, that's what I was wondering. The pain had to be excruciating.
It was pretty bad. Anyhow, I got up on the ship myself. Then he just grabbed me and led me to the first aid station. Well, it happened to be I said, you better get me somewhere because I'm going to be puking up pretty quick. I swallowed all the salt water and what. And he got me into the restroom in the heads, they call them. Yeah. Anyhow, and I know her, got her in there, and everything came up. And anyhow, by that time, there was a pharmacist mate already there taking care of me. And he gave me a shot. That's the last I remember. Within seconds, they a shot of morphine, whatever it was, knocked me out. Next thing I knew, I was in a bunk and woke up the next morning, laying in a bunk all bandaged up.
I imagine probably more than half your body was covered in bandages, huh?
Well, my back and my arms and my face wasn't. No, they didn't put any bandages on my face. It just singed enough just to make it swollen up and everything. And my ears were all swollen up, puffed up and everything. So, but where I was burnt the worst was my arms and my back. You can see my skin never has healed up. It always has been, every time it's a little cold, it's red. All of my fingernails, blew all my nails off, they turned black, and I took about three months, and they all grew back out again. But that was really the scariest part of my trip out there. I had a lot of other scares, but actually, if I go back to the very beginning of my Navy career, when I was in training, I was in a plane crash. And I survived that. Not only did I survive that, we had two PBYs taken off. And we crashed into each other. It looked like a P-38. One engine chewed into the wing of the other. If that prop had gone anywhere from 2, 3, 4 inches further, it would have hit the gas tanks on our plane. But fortunately, the engineer on each one of the planes, as soon as we hit, he cut the engines right away. And we just looked like a P-38.
I imagine there had to be some injuries from that.
Well, no, there was no injuries. We're still on the water. We were just ready to really pick up the speed enough to take off the water. And somebody, observer from one of the planes, they were not observing where they were going. They were probably too busy talking. But anyhow, that wasn't bad. Anyhow, it wasn't about a week or two later, we went on a gunnery flight. My crew had the two blisters on the back, had guns, and a nose gun had a gun, had 50 caliber machine guns, and they had targets towing the targets for practice. I had my turn at one of the guns, too, I shot. We had a couple of days in practice like that, but most of the time I was on the radio all the time. Anyhow, when this crash took place, I was on the radio sending in on the Morse code our takeoff time. With the little key, you know, da-da-da-da-da, and all that stuff. I was sending off our ticking time at the time when we crashed. And I was the only one that had life jackets. They were all in the bunk right across the seat from where I was. They were stacked up there. We never wore them normally. Everybody just left them there. They slung the train around, and the blisters on the back, we had the rest of the crew that were there in training. We're back there, probably 6 or 7 guys back there. They start screaming at me, get the life jackets out. So I start handing out the life jackets to them. And everybody got a life jacket, and we climbed out. We got out on the wing to get away in case caught on fire, because it only took a few minutes, and the rescue crews were out there. We were still in the bay. And anyhow, to get back to the other story, about 2 weeks later, we had gunnery practice. And the man, one of the guys, I knew him, he slept in the bunk, two bunks from me or whatever it was there. But anyhow, he was in the nose gun, and we finished our gunnery practice, and you're supposed to be sure your gun is empty every time when you get, and he had to get down, he had to scoot down and had the gun in front of him like this, tight quarters. Yeah. And he put down the gun in front of him like that. The gun went off. He had 3 bullets back in it, blew the top of his head off. That was the first time I really saw anybody really got hit bad. Maybe that made me feel good, because I knew I was going to have to be being worse than that.
So
anyhow, I had so many close calls. I should have been gone 5, 6, 7 times. I should have been dead. But I fortunately made it through. Somebody was watching over me.
Well, that was my question. I mean, when that happens, when you are that close so many times, when you're actually on fire and then almost drown, putting the fire out when you jump overboard, and then you got to deal with these horrific burns really for the rest of your life, how do you make sense of that and figure out why you're still here?
Well, you try to forget it, really. Yeah. I did. I just thanked the Lord. The things happened like they did. Yeah, and then you try to forget it. I just tried to forget it.
When you woke up after the morphine puts you out. You woke up and you've got bandages everywhere. You're burned all over the place. Did you think you'd ever get a chance to come back home and meet a pretty lady, still be married to her today, and have kids and grandkids?
I don't think I thought of those things at all. Yeah. I was just trying to survive, period.
Well, how thankful are you for all of that now, to realize how close you came?
I've been thankful, and I thank the Lord many, many times myself and my prayers and whatnot for what happened to me and that I got through all of that. For a long time, when I got back, I never spoke anything about the war I was in. Of course, my parents knew that I got burned because I still had the scars and vision. No, I didn't have scars, but I had the sight yet that, and I had to tell them how I got burned and whatnot. But other than that, we never discussed it.
So it affected your vision too?
No, it didn't affect my vision at all, no. It affected being aboard the ship with all the guns. All the shooting affected my hearing. That's why I have to have hearing aids. Until the last 10 years when we start having veterans get together and have meetings and get-togethers, then we start talking to each other about things like that. And we still do this, like the veterans group, that we meet once a month. Different guys will get up and talk about different things that they did that happened to them. But one time I had to give the story of my experiences to the officers club of Tulare County. They have about probably 50 or 100 of them. They're all admirals, captains, and generals and whatnot. And one of the guys I play golf with, he happened to be an officer in the Navy in the Vietnam War. And anyhow, he knew about the stuff I went through. He says, I'd like to have you come to our offices and give a talk. So I gave a talk there, and I said, well, I might be able to rake enough stuff to give you a 15-minute talk. I talked for 45 minutes, and I didn't realize I had talked that much. And it was like a morgue, and they're so quiet. And I couldn't believe it. And finally, I had one guy question me about something, and I gave him an answer that every person in that place, there must have been about, I guess there were probably 75 people at that meeting. They came up and shook my hand and thanked me. So I felt pretty good. They know them thanking me. They said they had never heard anybody tell the experience that I had.
That's why we do this show, because everybody's experience is different. Everyone is worth preserving. And, you know, there are a lot of guys who still haven't talked about it. So I wonder what you would say to them, what your experience has been. What has it meant to you to talk about it? What have you gotten out of telling your stories and not letting that story die with you?
No, I felt it was my duty to tell my family, and I never told them till later on when I start talking about it. I felt I should let somebody know what I went through, because I never was honored for this. Like the Vietnam people say, well, they went through all that war and they're never recognized. Well, I never was recognized for anything. I went through all that. I came back, went right back to my old routine, went back to work, and forgot about it. I said, I had to forget about it. I didn't want to think about it. Yeah, when all the different guys I saw killed on my ship, even, you know, guys with their arms blown off and shot in the legs and everywhere, I just didn't like to think about it.
Well, on behalf of all our listeners, I want to say thank you for serving our country, for telling us these stories. It's important for us to know. Why do you think it's important that we today, you've got a couple grandkids, a granddaughter just graduated college. Why do you think it's important for people like her to understand what you and all the guys like you did?
I don't know. I don't know how they feel about it, really. They don't have any idea. It's hard for me to tell them how I felt, you know, whatnot. And I never did think. I just took it for granted that was my job to do, really. I never resented the fact that I had to go to war. I never resented the fact that I went through all these things. The only thing I can be was thankful that I survived all of it. That's the old thing. Because I knew that I should have been gone many times. Well, I could tell you another story. When I went overseas, when I was assigned to go overseas, it came to Treasure Island in San Francisco. And from there, we were assigned to go to overseas. There were 12 of us passengers on a Liberty ship, is what it was. We were supposed to meet a convoy one or two days out. We were supposed to go on out to South Pacific. Well, we never did meet a convoy. We went by ourselves. to give keep us occupied. They gave us duty to do, Bart. So my duty was every fourth day, I had to go up in a crow's nest and watch for submarines. Well, when I got up to submarines, I saw what we're all loaded with all kinds of army equipment and stuff all over the decks. The front part of the deck was loaded with big steel containers. Oh, they're about 2.5-3 feet in diameter and probably 6-8 feet long or 10 feet long, whatever they were. The whole deck was loaded with up front. Fine, I asked us, what in the world are in those tanks up there? They said they're mustard and lewisite gas. We were taking it out to one of the islands to store because they had somehow got a rumor that they were afraid the Japs were going to start using the gas, and they wanted to have some out there just in case they needed it. But if we'd have got hit with all those chemicals aboard, now see, that's another thing. That started right, we were out of Golden Gate Bridge probably half a day when I was up in the crow's nest that night, and I saw those big drums, and I couldn't figure out what they were. But they unloaded them in the New Hebrides Islands, is where they stored them. Whatever happened to them, I don't know. I don't know whatever happened. They had to do something with them. I don't know if they just took them out and dropped them in the middle of the ocean after the war or what. You'd never know.
Another one of those mysteries. Well, I am so glad you survived all those close calls. Delighted that you could share those stories with all of us. That is John Lycum, 91 years old. Thanks to Rick Turner from the Visalia Country Club for letting me know about him. Maybe he'll be on hand to see Mr. Lycum nail that 7th hole-in-1 down there one of these days. We have some photos up at kmjnow.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page if you want to see that smiling face that told you all those stories today. And I hope you'll be here again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.